Tina Fey. It was August of 2008, and I was on Fire Island with my husband Jeff, and it was funny because he had the cover of the Times that said, McCain picks running mate, and he said he thought there was a resemblance. I said, I don't think so. It's just brown hair and glasses. But when we got back to the city, some cousins and old classmates were all saying, that lady looks like you. At that time, 30 Rock was not exactly highly rated, so no one really even knew that I wasn't even on SNL anymore. In fact, no one remembered that I didn't even really do sketches when I was on. So everyone thought they had the same good idea, that I should play Sarah Palin. It's funny because I was sort of arrogantly, in my own mind, resisting it. Like, I don't want to play that, and I don't know who's going to write it, and what if I don't like the way they wrote? People are going to think that I wrote it. And at some point, I realized that, like, oh, by the way, no one at SNL has actually asked me to do this. So I was like, oh, right. This is like a little argument that I'm having in my own mind. They haven't asked me to do this, and they don't really need me to do it. Kristen Wiig could certainly have done it with her eyes closed. It wasn't until late that week that Lorne called.
Lorne Michaels. Right after the debate, I'm coming out of my building the next day, and my doorman, Frank, says, Mr. Michaels, what a gift! Did you see it last night? And I go, yeah. And he says, it's Tina Fey! And I go, no, Frank, she's not on the show anymore. She's doing her own series. And I'm literally 30 feet away from my apartment, and Bobby De Niro's there with his daughter, and he goes, what a gift! And then I realized this was what everybody was thinking. So I called Tina and said, I think the audience is demanding that you do it. She said that Saturday was the only day that she could get Oprah Winfrey to appear on 30 Rock, so she would be filming all day with Oprah. She says, I can't do it. And I thought, Kristen can do it. But later that night we talked about it again, and Tina said, maybe we could rehearse Friday night late, and then I could just come for dress? Seth Meyers. It was that crazy thing where, of course, everyone knew we'd do a Sarah Palin sketch, and everyone knew Tina would play her. Because of that, there was this level of excitement that was both a good and bad thing, because I think we were all fairly terrified that we wouldn't execute on the potential. Two of the most recognizable women of American politics, impersonated by two great women of American comedy. It seemed to be, and was, a formula for surefire success, as the 34th season of Saturday Night Live got wildly underway on September 13, 2008. Tina Fey, immortally, played Sarah Palin, and Amy Poehler played Hillary Clinton in a sketch most memorable now for the line, I can see Russia from my house, uttered by Fey as Palin, but never by Palin herself. Although Palin said in an interview that parts of Russia could be seen from parts of Alaska, she never said she could see any of it from her house. Seth Meyers. The Russia from the house line? That was not first draft. I believe I'm going to give credit to Mike Shoemaker for that line. That was the thing about those sketches. You were constantly carrying them around and reading them for whoever you could get to listen, and people would just constantly pitch jokes. James Downey. To be honest with you, I didn't even think it was very well written. That's the one that's always played, I think more for politics than for comedy. The first one was the one where it was essentially Hillary going, I'm smart, and Sarah Palin going, I'm stupid. I'm smart, I'm stupid, I'm smart, I'm stupid. I thought it was kind of mediocre as a piece of writing, but as performing it was great. The performing is ultimately more important than the writing. It's like good pitching beats good hitting. A performer can lift mediocre material, but even the best written material, if the performance isn't there, can't make it through that filter.
Amy Poehler. You know who I think was most aware of how big that skit was going to be? It was my not-yet-born son, Archibald. Archibald was in my stomach during that sketch doing flips. I think I was probably 6 to 7 months pregnant, playing Hillary at that time, and I remember very specifically the wardrobe department, who, blessedly, kept having to make jackets that fit me in different various sizes during my time there. made a Hillary jacket with a split back because my stomach was so big and I was hiding behind the podium. And when we were doing the sketch, Archie was doing somersaults in my stomach and I was thinking, wow, he knows this is really exciting.
Lorne Michaels. It was at least as powerful as strategery. You could see perception changing completely. And it's in there. There have been these moments. It's Lovitz as Dukakis going, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. Or Chevy as Gerald Ford going, I was told there would be no math. All of those things that capture something that perfectly let you know where we are at that moment in our political consciousness. The audience that was suddenly watching Sarah Palin wasn't necessarily the SNL audience. Tina crossed over. It made her a huge star. John McCain, host. Very honestly, the portrayal of her was not fair, but it was certainly well done, and certainly probably the single most watched aspect of the political campaign over any other.
Tina Fey. When the internet really thinks they want something, it can easily turn out like, well, that wasn't as good as we thought. Having done so much on SNL, I was ready to be publicly rejected for it and was kind of fine with it. I said, all right, let's try it. It's probably going to stink. I was surprised that we got away with it. Amy Poehler. Playing Hillary and Sarah Palin was an indication of women taking center stage in politics in a way that I hadn't been able to experience in my time there. I started at SNL post 9/11. In fact, my first show was 2 weeks after 9/11 happened. And for the first 3 or 4 years of my time there, we could barely do anything political. Everyone and everything was so tender. And we had lost Will Ferrell as our Bush. Everything was so bad. The news was so bad. There was a lot of pop culture stuff, and getting to finally do really deep political parody at the end of my career there felt really satisfying. Television has been bending, distorting, and misrepresenting reality since it began, long before reality television was a genre. But the mixture of real, surreal, and fake reached a crazy new level when Sarah Palin appeared as herself on Saturday Night Live, watching and criticizing a sketch in which Tina Fey played her on a previous episode. Coddled gently on camera by producer Lorne Michaels, who was joined by actor Alec Baldwin, Palin didn't actually chat with Fey during the appearance, but the two did walk past each other. And it was Palin who got to shout the show's heraldic signature line, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." Later, proving herself a consummate good sport, Palin joined Seth Meyers at the update desk to say she'd decided not to do a planned rap number because it might just cross the line. But then she joined Meyers gyrating in rap rhythm as Poehler hip-hopped into the song, joined by Fred Armisen and Andy Samberg as Eskimos and a guy in a moose costume. Altogether a rollicking high point. Thus ended an amazing Mondo Bizarro moment in the history of the show, and perhaps in the history of the Republic.
Lorne Michaels. I called Alec to come in for it, to be standing with me, because he was the most emblematic liberal at that point. He said he had to introduce a documentary at the Hamptons Film Festival on that Saturday, so he wouldn't be able to do it. So I said, Alec, your instincts are always great, but are you telling me you're not going to be here for this thing that the whole world is waiting to see? These two women meeting each other, or at least interacting? You don't want to be here? You'd rather introduce this documentary? Well, you do what you have to do. I understand completely. We'll be here.
Tina Fey. I think I was the one pitching, why don't you start her backstage, you know, with Alec, so the crowd won't boo. She had just been booed at a hockey game in Philadelphia, and I thought we had to be cautious. And, of course, the audience was just happy to see her because she was a star, a media star. Even the New York audience was not feeling their politics at that moment.
Lorne Michaels. Tina was terrified of anything where they would be together looking like an endorsement. When you're standing next to somebody, it's hard, very hard, not to be gracious and not want to see another person in stress, particularly on the show. Governor Palin got here at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She was great. She has wonderful manners, and I honestly don't mean this in a condescending way, but it's that pageant winner thing. Like, if there were young girls around, she'd spend time. She'd ask questions. It was her daughter's 16th birthday. She could not have been more gracious or warmer. She showed up fully dressed, like a candidate would be, and then did everything and didn't question anything.
Sarah Palin. I know that they portrayed me as an idiot, and I hated that, and I wanted to come on the show and counter some of that. I love to disarm people. I love to meet them face to face, and as a result of being on the show, being able to at least meet like Tina Fey's in-laws, whom I adore, that was a valuable connection right there. And to meet Lorne Michaels in person, that was nice. And just all the characters, it was great. But I was certainly aware of how they were portraying me. Unfortunately, I have to admit that I was getting used to it. Knowing that that was the reality, you know, you make the best of the situation. You either become bitter or you become better, based on the maybe less than ideal circumstances in front of you. SNL portrayals of me were less than ideal, but they let me get on there and have some fun and capitalize on what they're doing to me.
Ken Among. What can I say? The show had been pretty hard on her up to that point, to say the least, but she was amazing, very easygoing. She didn't hide out, she stayed on the studio floor, and she gladly went along with everything that happened in the show. Seth Meyers. She was incredibly charismatic and game. She couldn't have been friendlier through the whole process, and obviously she would have had every reason to have her guard up. I'm not saying she didn't, but I only had pleasant interactions with her. I felt that the opening sketch, where there were so many moving parts, was the less memorable part of that show, whereas the Amy Palin rap becomes the part of that show that you always remember. You could just tell in the house. You didn't have to go online to know how that stuff was playing. The times at SNL where I was confident enough that I would just walk out on the floor and watch a piece are few and far between. I pace beneath the bleachers more. But you could just tell it was like Wayne's World.
Paula Pell. That whole time Sarah Palin came to do her little appearance, the actual Sarah Palin, I planned that I was going to come up and talk to her and shake her hand and welcome her and say, "My wife and I are very good people, and we live a very socially conscious life, and we do a lot for our community. And I just want you to know the face of gay couples and gay people." And I had this whole speech planned. Then I just kind of came up to her in the chaos of the hallway and just nodded and said, "Hi," and walked off. I thought to myself, I'm such a chicken shit. I was like, wow, she's pretty. I just got overwhelmed by the fact that this character who was everywhere on TV was in front of me, and she was real and just ridiculous. So I didn't get my big political moment. Sarah Palin. I'd been a fan and my siblings had been fans of the show since we were quite young. We used to sneak into our TV room so we could watch SNL because our parents thought, or appropriately, believed, that it was not such a positive thing to be watching. But we snuck into our TV room and we would watch the show. So having an opportunity during the campaign to be on the show was awesome. It was a blast.
Seth Meyers. Tina and I, more than anyone else, felt the burden of having to constantly do better with the next one. In the end, we probably did 6 sketches or so in the course of 7 or 8 weeks. So it was one after the other, and I was just happy in the end that there was never the one that made people go, "Well, that's it, the party's over." And I will say that I wrote the first draft of most of those, but they were always a group effort. Everyone was paying such close attention to that election, including everyone on the writing staff, and everybody had points of view on it. The jokes would always get better as the week went on. People would see Tina and just lose their minds, and then all the jokes worked.
Sarah Palin. Even today, I'll walk by the TV that's maybe on in our living room, and I'll glance up, and once in a while, I still see that same old Tina Fey, the portrayal of me. And I do a double take. I think, what am I doing on TV today? Oh, it's Tina Fey! It's weird. What really kills me is that people believe that I said the things that Tina Fey said in her funny comedy sketch. That tells you that, yeah, there is that impact on part of the electorate that SNL has. Another thing that's significant here is that SNL is able to kind of ratchet down what the debate is to a level that is culturally relevant. And that's important, and quite significant. So it's important to, again, get on the show, disarm them if you can, and play along with it in order to ultimately get your message out there.
James Downey. The 2008 election had that really interesting thing going on between Obama and Hillary in the front half, and in the back half you had Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin. I never thought the writing for the Sarah Palin character was particularly great until the last one, the vice presidential debate. But her performance was so incredibly great. It's one of the all-time great political impressions. It's up there to me with Dana Carvey doing Ross Perot and Daryl's Gore. It was just phenomenal. You just got that thank you, God, kind of break where you had Sarah Palin and Tina Fey on the planet at the same time. You can't count on getting those kinds of things. Horatio Sanz. I always kind of felt bad when Will Ferrell did his Bush impression because he was such a good old boy that you really didn't think, oh, this evil little rich prick whose dad and his friends got him in office. You thought, oh, he's just a good old guy I'd like to drink beer with. As funny as Will's impression was, and as funny as that take was, the audience as a whole, the whole country, would probably see that as, oh, I like Bush, because he's Will. You know, if Will hadn't done that impression, or at least made him likable, it may have tipped it the other way. I honestly think so. We made up for it. I think Tina's impression basically killed Sarah Palin. I think that helped get rid of Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin. I think SNL is egotistical if they believe that it was truly an effect on maybe the public debate about who should lead the country in the next 4 years. I don't believe that it was that impacting. But certainly it was impacting for a segment of our culture, and I'm a testimony to that because growing up, again, with my siblings, we did tune in to SNL, and we did listen to what it was they were saying in regards to cultural or political or societal jokes. Not so much influenced by them, but certainly opening our minds to what it was that SNL was trying to portray.
Seth Meyers. What made the election campaign for me was the fact that John McCain came on and played himself, and Tina played Sarah Palin, and they were just standing out there next to each other. It was just as surreal a moment as I can remember on SNL. It was great. And I remember between Dress and Air, we added Cindy McCain, who was wonderful as well. It was a really fun night, and when we're talking about a good sport, I think it's hard to find one better than John McCain. John McCain. During the campaign itself, I would argue that Saturday Night Live has as much impact on younger Americans as any other aspect of a political campaign. A politician, a candidate, cannot control it. But if you don't try, you can be sure that you won't reach them. I certainly had no trepidation about appearing on the show, and despite the failure of the campaign, it was probably the best way I knew to gain communication with the younger voters, who certainly didn't watch the debates and probably didn't come to campaign rallies. Even though they may not pay as much attention as you want, they're pretty well informed as to what's going on politically, which is why the Saturday Night Live skits on politicians are so popular. So it was an incredibly useful way to get in touch with them. I trust Lorne Michaels and the writers on the show. One of the highlights, frankly, of my political career was when I was able to host Saturday Night Live. And so when Lorne asked me back, I was really happy to do it. And the skits were good, especially the McCain-Feingold skit. People still come up to me and talk about it. Lorne Michaels. McCain is great with me. He came on that weekend of the election, that Saturday before the Tuesday, and did the thing with Tina, and Cindy came with him. Tina did not want to be in the same shot, but but I staged it so that they would just pass each other. Seth Meyers. I can't imagine any outcome where it would have been more tailor-made for comedy than the 2008 election was. From the very beginning, that was the sound of puzzle pieces fitting together. And 2012 I'm very happy with. I feel like we executed it with what we had to deal with, but I don't think any one of us went into it feeling we were going to top 2008. Brian Williams. I don't think we can correctly assess yet the show's impact on politics or popular culture. The number of times in life people say it would make a great sketch on SNL is equaled by the number of times in life people almost knowingly are making judgments on politicians that are based on SNL depictions and nothing else. I think it has an immeasurable ability to set the agenda. Now, is it mostly for an audience of the coastal intelligentsia? Perhaps, except for the Internet. The Internet has really launched the show in a new way. The Internet has come along like sweet pea at the end of a girder and swept up SNL into its loving arms.
Sarah Palin. If I ran into Tina Fey again today, I would say, "You need to at least pay for my kids' braces or something from all the money that you made off pretending that you're me. My goodness, you capitalized on that. Can't you contribute a little bit? Jeez!" Amy Poehler. In a very ridiculous way, I was thinking that I had control over when my baby was going to come. I thought, I'm going to do this last show with John Hamm on Saturday, and then I'm going to have the baby on Sunday, and there you go! Just 5 days earlier, I had wrapped the Sarah Palin sketch and still felt like I could finish the show. And then my child, Archie, had other plans. On Friday night, he decided he wanted to start coming, and he wanted to get there by Saturday. And so I texted Mike Shoemaker and Seth in the middle of the night and said, "I'm not going to make the show tomorrow." From what I understand, it was really exciting because everyone had these fill-ins for my parts. Elizabeth Moss filled in for herself in a Madman sketch, and she met Fred Armisen that night, and a year later, on my son's birthday, they were married. That was also the night where Seth had to do update for the first time, and I held my newborn son in my arms as I watched Maya and Keenan sing a song to me and him. Seth tapped on the update desk, which he does now pretty regularly out of a lovely habit, and I felt it was really one of those really incredibly moving moments where all these moments in my life were happening at the same time, and I felt my heart crack open. It was just love with a capital L all over there. Getting it, receiving it, feeling it, seeing this little person, my first son, and seeing the people I loved so much at my job. It felt very real to me, and it is very real to me. I treasure the love and relationships that I have there and continue to have because of that job. Abby Elliott, cast member. I sent them a bunch of tapes, and then they called me in L.A. to come in and do 5 minutes on stage. I really thought it was such a long shot, that there was no way that I could get it, so I wasn't as nervous as I think one would normally be. After the audition, I stayed in Connecticut for a couple of days to hang out with my family, and we were out to eat, and I got a call saying, "Lorne wants to meet with you on Monday," which usually meant you were being considered for the job. And so I stayed, met with him, and afterward I went off alone and burst into tears in Steve Higgins's office, and he gave me a shot of whiskey. I left for L.A. that night, and when I landed I turned my phone on, and I had gotten the job. All my friends knew before I did, and Lauren called my dad, and that was really exciting. So I flew back to New York on the red eye that night and was at the table read the next day. I came in really young, 21, the youngest female. I was really wide-eyed and didn't have any idea what I was getting into, and that was exciting to me. I wanted to do that. Whatever I was jumping into, it was going to be a shock to my system.
Akiva Schaffer. With jizz in my pants, we thought the word jizz was filthy. It was really, really dirty, and that there was no way it could ever air. And then Friday night around 9, we were like, Lorne, we have this video. I have a rough cut here. We can't figure out how to make it clean. Usually Lorne would see our videos for the very first time in dress rehearsal, and then if he had a note afterwards, he would give it to us, and we would do a quick edit between dress and air. In this case, we showed it to him on Friday. We knew it was funny, but we couldn't figure out how to make a clean version. And we just wanted to show it to him in case he had any ideas or anything, and then we were going to work on it through the next week. So he said, "This is for next week's show?" And I said, "Here it is." And we played him the dirty version, and he said, "I think we could air that." We were shocked. We were very shocked. And then we went all the way up to Jeff Zucker, who happened to be at the show that night. He watched it and said, "Yeah, you can air that, after 12:30. So it aired at 12:45, as is, which shocked me, because I thought jizz was a much dirtier word than dick.
Amy Poehler. Lorne does a very lovely and charming thing, which is he doesn't let you tell him that you're going to leave. He evades it for as long as he can, so I don't remember ever really telling him. I think I did in some way, and I think he kept just kind of nodding and being, "Uh-huh, but you'll come back for a few more." And then I remember coming back for a few more.
Robert Smigel. That era sort of defied the argument you always hear that SNL needs to have something for everyone. If you don't hate a few sketches, we're not doing our job, etc. That cast, especially around my last few years there, had a very consistent sensibility. They worked as a team in a way that I don't really remember ever feeling in any of the eras that I worked there, as great as those other groups were. So many combinations of performers yielded brilliant, weird sketches, like Potato Chip with Forte and Sudeikis. Top to bottom, probably the hippest group since the originals. That whole universe that started with Fred and Kristen and Forte, and expanded to Samberg and Bill Hader and the rest. And you still had people like Amy and Maya for a hunk of this time. They were great performers, and they were all writers. And Seth really let the cast blossom and wrote funny, smart stuff on top of it. I feel like it should be looked at as a golden era, but I don't know if it gets that credit. Maybe it's because of the shadow of Ferrell. They had to follow the greatest cast member ever.
Amy Poehler. It feels really good to have people not want you to leave. It's very, very hard to leave. But I felt like it was time to end it. That's when I'd been doing sketch comedy for 15 years or something, and I thought maybe it was time to play one character for a while. In my fantasy world, Gilda and I would have been best friends. In my fantasy world, Eddie Murphy would have been like, "I don't really think white women are funny, but you're really great." I wish that I had met Phil Hartman. I think about that sometimes. He's someone I would have really liked to have met and worked with, and sadly, I didn't get that chance. But certainly Gilda. They were such comedy giants for me. I can't really imagine sharing the same air as them. It's interesting. Whenever you parachute into SNL, the time that you parachute in, it has to work. I was extremely lucky to come at a time when women were dominating, when my friends were working there, and where I felt like I had some chops, having worked at UCB. So I was lucky in the time that I came. I can't imagine what it would be like in a different time, in a sliding doors universe when I was there at a different time. I don't know how I would have fit in, or if I would have fit in at all, because there's certainly a lot of people that have come through SNL who are so supremely talented and didn't quite maybe get to scratch the itch in a way that they did through other jobs. It's really a combination of a lot of things.
Robert Smigel. Fred's David Patterson impression actually originated on Night of Too Many Stars, an autism benefit my wife and I do with Jon Stewart for Comedy Central. Lorne actually produced the first one for me at NBC, and SNL cast members have always been a huge part of it. Sandler, Ferrell, Tina, Jimmy, Amy, Fred, Maya, and Forte have all done it multiple times. In 2008, Patterson had just taken over as governor after Spitzer's sex scandals and almost immediately confessed, in great detail, to committing adultery. I thought Fred could look just like him, so I asked him to play Patterson for us. We put him at the celebrity phone bank, and while our jokes mostly focused on his eagerness to share TMI, we couldn't resist having him speaking into a stapler instead of a phone. SNL took it all way farther, with greater success. They made him a complete, very funny, regular character. After all the support I'd received from SNL, it was nice that we could return the favor even a little bit. Much better than a gift bag. John Mulaney, writer. One of the strangest things I remember was during my first season, during the fall of 2008. It was a really big time at the show with all the wonderful Sarah Palin stuff, but it was also a nerve-wracking time. I remember the last show at Christmas. Rob Klein and Colin Jost and I wrote an update feature where Fred played Governor David Paterson, the governor of New York. And Fred happened to look identical to David Paterson when he put on a beard. I've never seen someone look more like the person they were impersonating. And we wrote this update feature about New York, now that Paterson, who was blind, had taken over from Spitzer. Fred slid out to the update desk from offstage on a swivel chair, but kept sliding, going past Seth. And Lorne, Mike Shoemaker, everyone, laughed so goddamn hard. It was pretty insane to see Lorne laugh that hard. Colin, Rob, and I were laughing too, but it was amazing to see Lorne like something that much. It was Mike Shoemaker's last show, and we were under the bleachers after Shoemaker ran over and said, "Not a bad way to end this first year. That's pretty cool to see Lorne falling all over himself laughing." And it really was. Then the next day there were headlines everywhere. Did SNL go too far in Fred playing David Paterson? And I had just gotten home for Christmas, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be fired. We're all going to be fired for doing this. I knew enough to know that they thought the piece was really funny and that we had done it with the best intentions. Much to the show's and Fred's amazing credit, we kept doing them, because Paterson was never the butt of the joke, he was the joke maker. We wrote him like a comedian who burned everyone else, especially New Jersey. Though we didn't want to offend anybody, it was kind of interesting to have the New York Times saying, "To call this humor sophomoric would be an insult to sophomores." And I was just like, oh my God, how New York Timesy. It was a great added fun element to writing those that we were bothering some people. One of the most surreal moments was when Governor Paterson came on the show 2 years later to do a segment with Fred and Seth. The way Governor Paterson and his team would work is that they would record speeches for him so that he could memorize them, and he would listen to the tapes. So they had a blocking rehearsal where he sat at the desk and I'd sit next to him reading the update feature, reading his part, and Fred reading his part, so that he would have it on tape. Paterson took home my voice to learn his bit in the update feature. Someone took a photo of me standing next to Paterson, who is laughing, luckily, reading all of these lines that he's going to have to say the next night. Those Paterson ones? Colin and Rob and I just laughed a lot writing them. It was really fun. Fred was so good about it, and it became just a fully formed character. The added thing of people being pissed off about it, at that age, was kind of exciting.
Paula Pell. I've always marveled at the way SNL sort of bleeds into everyone's consciousness, and especially living in New York, on Sundays, I would always go to a diner, go eat somewhere, and I would marvel at how many people were talking about SNL. And that happens a lot anyway, but during that period of time there was such constant immersion of connecting SNL with just the campaigns. On every news show, they would show a clip. It was just really feeling wonderful and relevant that we were constantly in the forefront of that. And I think that's because Tina and Amy and Seth were writing those debate sketches. The years of SNL feeling relevant always kind of come and go. And it's always unique, and it's always there in people's consciousness. And people watch it in different eras of their life. But at that moment, it felt like everyone was watching it. Sarah Palin was just pennies from heaven. An amazing gift to comedy, that woman.
Daryl Hammond. What was it like after I left? You're talking about living on the moon and then not living on the moon. It's kind of like what astronauts who've walked on the moon talk about when they're playing shuffleboard in Arizona. You were on the moon, but now you don't have those experiences anymore. It's a culture shock. When I did my last show, it wasn't even acknowledged. Will Ferrell, who was hosting, said something, but it wasn't anything like, "Hey, this is your last show." I mean, he was good when I was there, so it wasn't anything like that. And Will said something again at the good night. Otherwise, people weren't that moved. No one ever really consulted me, partially because I don't know anything about how to put a show like that together. I wanted to leave after my 11th year, but there were some people who had advised me very well in my life who kept advising me to stay on. But I knew in my heart of hearts that it wasn't right anymore. By my 12th year, people didn't even know I was on the show anymore. I knew the scripts were going to stop coming, and they did. I had a giant management agency tell me to stay. I had 1,000 people telling me, stay. But it wasn't right. It wasn't right. No one knows how to leave there, and no one knows how to get on there. Lorne wanted me to stay, but I felt like I had achieved my dream and that it was time for me to go. It's part of the aesthetic. I haven't known any place like it. It was just as painful for me to be there when I knew it was wrong. All of it was frustrating. I never did as well as I wanted to. That's why I never watched reruns, because I thought if I only had one more hour, I could have done better. Finesse Mitchell. I just think I partied too much. I enjoyed New York. I really enjoyed New York. I enjoyed being on the show, and had I focused more on the show and characters and stuff and really getting better, I probably would have been a good 5 years or 6 years on the show before I left. Man, I went out every night. I probably went out every night except Friday night. Yeah, I mean, we got treated great at the clubs, and then there were some hosts that would come in that wanted to go out. So we would take them out on a Thursday night. You know, your Lindsay Lohans or your Colin Farrells. And then you get that guest that wants to go out. And then Keenan and myself just used to go out so much. We just clubbed, clubbed, and more clubs. And then I had another buddy who was on Broadway, and he was from Atlanta. So it was always like 3 or 4 of us going out, staying out until like 3 or 4 in the morning. Sometimes leaving the house at like 2 in the morning and coming back at like, you know, 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning. But that was the great thing about New York. You could leave so late and they let you go clubbing and come back to SNL to finish writing on Tuesday night. And in addition to that, SNL had some great events that they wanted everybody to go to. So that was kind of special, too. You know, go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or Mark Twain Awards at the Kennedy Center. Being a Gemini, you don't like the same things for a long time, but I enjoyed the whole experience.
Paula Pell. I had always been just a casual pot smoker. I had never bought pot in New York, and so I bought pot from someone at work. And I had it like, I'm a super slow pot smoker. So I'd buy a small amount and have it for, like, weeks and months. And then Shoemaker came into my office one night and he goes, "I'm going to see the Kids in the Hall movie. I heard that you're the one who had pot. You're the connection." I said, "If I'm the connection, the drug connection at Saturday Night Live now, then it has fallen very far. And it should be ashamed of itself that I am the drug connection, because I still have a joint in my jewelry box from, like, 1982. And so it just made me laugh so hard that people were all talking and going, "Yeah, I think Paula smokes pot. Go, I think she has pot." I thought, you know, for a place that, you know, probably had drugs delivered regularly, it just cracked me up how far it had changed.
Fred Armisen. I'm not into drugs. I don't drink. The old casts had their method, and I've only heard about it. So all I could do is hear stories and think, wow, they made it work. But I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Paula Pell. Actors on the show now are just more health conscious. They'll order from a super healthy place at work, and you just see people on the show wanting to be healthier in life. The only romances now are just kind of like sweet, open romances that happen when people kind of fell for each other and are going together. There are one or two, but there are very few, and very out-in-the-open relationships. None of it is sordid. None of it is outside of marriages. There's just very little scandal here. There's very few Page Six moments with SNL anymore. Maybe some of that has trickled down from Lorne, and not that I think he was ever the origin of the debauchery, but, you know, he's raising a family, And he's also a health nut. He's certainly healthier than me, and I'm younger than him. I said to Steve Higgins the other day, you are the age that Lorne was when he hired us. And that really freaked us out. We were like, holy shit! Because I thought of him as this elder person when I got hired, and I'm like his age now, so... But he's so frickin' healthy, and it just sets the example. I mean, there's some of those dudes who, they stay up all night, you know, and go out and party, and they're young and they can do that and then eat pizza at 8 in the morning and they're good with it. Lindsay Shukas. They seem to be a little more responsible about going home earlier and making sure they're going to get their beauty sleep. When I started, it felt like it was a little more lively. They would just throw caution to the wind a little bit more, you know? Well, we'll figure it out. Now it seems a little bit more thought through, and people are much more like, you know, well, I want my trainer appointment in the morning, or they're going to go home so they can look good the next day, which is smart. They're going on camera. They should look good. It makes my job easier, so I can't complain too much. It's still a lot of fun. It's just maybe, like, more thought-out fun, where there will be a certain night where people stay for one night, as opposed to it all seeming to be one big party. It's like, save it for Saturday, or save it for the writer's party we have one night, you know?
Yorma Taconi. We worked all the time. That was my home in an entirely different way. I slept on every couch in the place. The kind of dedication that it takes to make a show like that is the kind of dedication that was there from the moment the show started. People live there. I showered in Lauren's office. I've showered downstairs, probably in the same places that Belushi did all that stuff. I mean, you live there. That's your home, and that's the only way to make it happen. My only regret is we never made a documentary about how to make one of those shorts. It's amazing, because that show now looks so seamless. People would often ask us when SNL was filmed. Filmed? It's live. Dan Aykroyd. It was all-consuming, that's for sure. I think those kids there today suffer from the same thing. They only have one day off, Sunday. But that's got to be one of the greatest jobs in television, working there, for all time. They're very fortunate to be there. I look at Second City as the BA program in comedy and improv and writing, and I look at Saturday Night Live as the master's program, and then after that point in life, you get your PhD in whatever you go into. So I would say I probably have enough knowledge to teach a graduate-level course in film production now, but definitely Saturday Night Live is the master's program. John Mulaney. When I first came to the show, I thought, this thing will be competitive. Some people will be toxic. It'll be very cold. I thought to myself, this will be a great experience, but this might be really hard, and you could get fired, and you'll go back to being a stand-up, and it'll be okay. I had to keep telling myself that when I got hired. I started in 2008, and by then Mike Shoemaker and Seth Meyers in particular had created an environment that was so nice. It was a very cool moment in time. The fall of 2008 was amazing for the show, and there was just a great vibe in the air. Everyone wrote together. We had one big rewrite table. All the writers would work with each other. Everyone cross-pollinated. It was not a jaded environment. It was really very friendly, very supportive. We were all just together a lot. Colin Jost. We were all fans of the show and knew the lore of the show, and so we kind of knew the history of that at the show. We knew that people used to have crazier nights out and do crazier things. I think a bit of it is almost the way people react to their parents, where you learn from that and you're like, oh, are these people happy? Are their lives happy? Maybe there's a way for me to deal with it some other way that's not like drugs or fighting. Maybe there's a way... Maybe in the long run, that's a happier existence, which doesn't make for as good a story, but is happier. And I think it's that as much as people being tamer now. Robert Smigel. That era sort of defied that logic that you needed to have the hippest group of people for the show to succeed. The show then not only had the comedy, but a consistent level of sophistication I admired. The cast was really working as a team in a way that I don't really remember ever feeling in any of the eras that I worked there. That whole universe that started with Fred and Kristen and Will Forte expanded to Samberg and Bill Hader. They were great performers and they were all writers. I feel like it's looked on as a true golden year. Maybe it's because of the shadow of Farrell. He's the greatest cast member ever. I remember telling Will that on his last show, and I think it really meant something to him because I had been around for so long. Christopher Walken. A few years ago, because of work, I literally went around the world. I think I went from New York to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to Australia, then back by way of Singapore. We flew to London, then Paris, then back to New York, and back to Los Angeles, right around the world. And every hotel that I stayed in, I turn on the TV and there was SNL. I'm not sure that people realize the ubiquity of the show. Even in remote places around the world, people watch SNL. It's everywhere.